listening to the WFYI Weekly News Podcast for the week of October 12th through 16th, 2015. I'm Christopher Ayers. This week, a lawsuit involving large-scale animal feeding operations poses a challenge to Indiana's right-to-farm laws.
Oh, wow. It really does stink.
At Arlington Community High School, some students stick around for fall break.
You need to exhaust every opportunity that you get in order to be able to pass the test.
And we take a look at a dance program for kids with Down syndrome. Those stories and more are coming up. Please stay tuned. For university professors, tenure is the ultimate goal. It's a prestigious level of job security because to qualify, faculty members have to meet criteria that often take years to reach. Last week, the Purdue University Board of Trustees approved updates to its promotion and tenure policy that would require tenured professors to spend more time mentoring students. State Impact Indiana's Claire McInerney explains why the trustees view the updates as huge strides, even though many Purdue faculty members find them unnecessary.
The process of updating Purdue's tenure policy started a few years ago when a number of graduates expressed through a survey that they wanted more of a connection with their teachers. That sentiment was so overwhelming that it compelled the Board of Trustees to bring it to the Provost of Academic Affairs, Deba Dutta.
And one of the things that they wanted me to look at is to make sure that faculty understand mentoring of students is very important. They wanted me to look at the faculty involvement and encouragement of student research, undergraduate student research, to give them opportunities to do research and guided by faculty.
The board also wanted to encourage tenured professors to find innovative ways to teach and create new practices for instruction. They were able to address all of these concerns in an updated policy that they passed last week, but not without some faculty pushback. Biological sciences professor David Sanders says he felt insulted by the language requiring professors to mentor students because it implies faculty are currently not doing so.
I fully believe in mentorship. I mentor undergraduate researchers all the time. It's very competitive, in fact, to get into my lab in order to become mentored by me, and I'm very proud of what I've been able to achieve with them.
But Dutta says the language wasn't necessarily intended to fix a problem. He believes most Purdue faculty already prioritize mentoring their undergraduate students. He just wanted to put the words to paper.
It puts it in the policy document and makes a statement to the rest of the world and to the student body right now that this is an institution where faculty pay a lot of attention to the success of the student. It just makes that statement.
The language for the mentorship requirement states that a professor must show, quote, commitment to active and responsive mentorship, as well as an active role in mentoring, advising, and supporting the academic success of students, end quote. That's language that Sanders says is way too vague to be effective.
What does commitment to mentorship mean? How am I supposed to demonstrate commitment? I love mentorship. I'm going to marry mentorship. I mean, what does commitment to mentorship actually mean there?
Board of Trustees Chair Mike Berghoff says the trustees aren't mandating specific actions in terms of mentorship, including students in research, or improving teaching practices.
All we really cared about was making sure that if somebody was being considered, the needle wasn't on zero on any of those three areas. We weren't sure how best to measure it. We just knew in most cases, zero wasn't enough.
Purdue faculty made many revisions that are reflected in the final version of the tenure policy. For example, they shared concerns that not all faculty are involved in research or other collaborative projects in which to include students, and they didn't want that to be a barrier to receiving tenure. And the trustees listened. Berghoff says faculty input was crucial to create a realistic policy.
And I'm also appreciative of the faculty's help. I know there was some thinking that we were maybe discouraged by redlining and removal, and not at all. It really made the process better.
Dutta says it's been more than 30 years since the university updated this promotion and tenure policy, and he is pleased with the changes the faculty and trustees came up with. In fact, he says he wants to revisit the document every 5 years to make any necessary updates. But Professor Sanders says that's not a logical way to attract the best talent.
Well, there are people who are starting now under one set of rules, and then you're going to change the criteria on them in the middle? That doesn't sound, to be changing them constantly really doesn't sound like a way that's going to be attractive to people who want to come to Purdue. It's not going to be a very strong recruitment tool if we're constantly changing the criteria.
The new policy takes effect January 1st, 2016, and will apply to all future educators going through the tenure process. For State Impact Indiana, I'm Claire McInerney.
Indianapolis nonprofit Kids Dance Outreach is offering a brand new dance program for children with Down syndrome. The group partnered with neurologists and physical therapists from the Peyton Manning Children's Hospital and Riley Hospital for Children to create high-level dance classes that improve both physical and emotional skills. Last Monday, the group's director, Michael Johnson, and Amy Imbiden, one of the participants' parents, stopped by WFYI to talk with Jill Dittmeyer.
Well, this is an exciting new program, but Michael, first remind our listeners what Kids Dance Outreach does all the time.
Well, Kids Dance Outreach is a nonprofit based right here in Indianapolis, and our mission is to bring opportunity and improve the lives of children who are too often left out of high-quality dance outreach programs.
And you are a former ballet dancer, and so you have little feats on experience, I guess.
Yes, I'm a graduate of Butler University. I majored in arts administration, then I joined the Boston Ballet. I was a dancer there for 10 years, and then I taught in Boston Ballet's outreach program.
So basically, you kind of go into schools and work with students who wouldn't normally be able to have dance.
Yes, we partner with schools, and we bring our program right into the schools, and we work 8 or 9 weeks, depending on what the school calendar is. We partner with the principals and work out the days and the times, but most of our programming happens during school time, so that way no children are left out.
And literally, the new program reaches a whole new aspect. A whole new group of kids are not going to be left out from dance. Children with Down syndrome. And this is an exciting new program. You spent 2 years piloting with the Peyton Manning Children's Hospital. And today you are announcing that it's going to give it a try.
We are really excited to announce the Kids Dance Outreach Adaptive Dance Program. This is a program designed specifically for children with Down syndrome. And children with Down syndrome have other needs. And what we've done is adjusted our material, and we feel like we have the dance expertise because myself and my associate director, Monica Munoz, we've been dancers our entire life. My experience in Boston working with people from all over the world, artists, has brought me to this point. And we're very excited to be launching this program for all the children that are right here in Indianapolis that need this opportunity and will benefit greatly from the confidence, persistence, and the discipline that we're instilling, not to mention the physical activity.
And Amy, you know that for sure because your daughter Zoe has been part of this program. Tell me what Zoe was like before being part of this program and what she's like now.
Well, to be honest, we were having a little bit of trouble with Zoe at home because of her high level of defiance and not wanting to sometimes participate in group activities inside the home or outside the home when we would go to other places, pulling herself away from kids, wanting more attention for herself than being able to be okay with being a level in a group, being an equal in a group setting.
And so you have seen great progress in her, and you're looking forward to being other children to be able to take part in this.
Yes, we saw huge progress, and pretty quickly, within the first few weeks of her participating, we started to look at each other and say, hey, this is really working. You know, she's more pleasant, her confidence level is growing, and that helps everything, because then she doesn't feel like she has to take all the attention for herself. She feels like she has something to give to other people. It's just such a gift to her to be treated with such a high level of respect and equality. In this program, the kids aren't talked down to or looked down to. The teachers are above board in talking to the students and about the students when the students aren't around. Never a negative comment. It's all about building up. It's all completely positive. And to be honest, as a mom, I've not found that anywhere else.
KidsDanceOutreach.org to learn more about this new program. Thank you all for coming in and continued success with the good work that you do here in the community.
Thanks very much, Jill.
Thank you.
In 2005, then-Governor Mitch Daniels announced plans to double pork production in Indiana by the year 2025, drawing large-scale producers to the state. But as the size of the farms grew to raise more pork, there was an unintended and for many unwelcome side effect: the smell emanating from increasingly common concentrated animal feeding operations, also known as CAFOs. As Side Effects Public Media's Jake Harper reports, that smell could be harmful to the health of nearby residents, and last week it sparked a lawsuit that could threaten the state's powerful right-to-farm laws.
Dick Himsel's property is kind of what you'd expect in a rural Indiana neighborhood. There are trees lining the driveway, a nice white two-story home, and it's surrounded by tall stalks of corn, which Himsel used to farm before he retired. One thing the property does not have, though, is fresh air.
Oh, wow. It really does stink.
I definitely see what you're talking about now with the smell.
I would like to smell that all day long, every day.
Oh, my gosh.
And it gets worse.
The smell comes from a factory farm where approximately 8,000 hogs eat, sleep, and defecate, a little more than a quarter mile from Himsel's home.
It's mild today. It's probably hard for you to believe, but it is mild today.
Wow. Himsel has lived his entire life in Danville, Indiana, but these days he doesn't like to spend time at home. The smell is nauseating. He and his wife, Janet, along with some other neighbors, say they've had regular headaches and persistent coughs since the CAFO first started operating 2 years ago. And he says his property value has dropped by a lot.
The house is $0, and it's a nice home, real nice.
So last week, the Himsels filed a nuisance suit against the farm with the help of Kim Ferraro of the Hoosier Environmental Council. She says successfully suing a farm for these problems is especially hard.
If you were a landowner who lived next to any other type of industrial facility, a steel mill, a cement plant, you would be able to sue for nuisance. But that's not the case for people who live in agricultural areas.
So why is it harder to sue a farm than it is a power plant? It's complicated. Dust and gas coming from farms can cause health problems like bronchitis, asthma, nausea, headaches, and eye irritation. The Environmental Protection Agency recognizes the potential risks for nearby residents, and even the pork industry is aware of the problems. Josh Trinery of Indiana Pork.
The industry is concerned about their potential impacts on the environment and human health, and so we know that we need good estimators of emissions, and so we've worked with EPA to gather that data.
But after years of studying the subject, the EPA has yet to put guidelines in place. In the meantime, air emissions from CAFOs go unchecked.
These CAFOs emit tremendous amounts of particulate matter, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, which, if they were coming from any other industry, would be regulated under the Clean Air Act.
As in other states in recent years, Indiana's Right to Farm Act was strengthened in 2005. And Kim Ferraro thinks that law and a new one passed just last year go too far to protect what are now much bigger farms.
We're all supposed to be equal under the eyes of the law, and courts are supposed to decide cases fairly and be objective arbiters of the facts.
So she argues the laws are actually unconstitutional. There have been a number of cases that have tried unsuccessfully to make the same basic argument, so it's an uphill battle. But Ferraro thinks she has a solid legal strategy. She's prepared to take the case all the way to the Indiana Supreme Court. And if she wins, it could impact other states with similar right-to-farm legislation.
You sit down, eat a meal, you smell it. You go to bed at night, you smell it.
For Dick and Janet Himsel, winning would mean finally getting rid of the smell that has bothered them for the last 2 years and living comfortably at home again. Jake Harper, Side Effects Public Media.
And finally this week, not every Indianapolis Public School student was out of class this fall break. At Arlington Community High School, some students were required to attend remedial math and English lessons to help them pass required exams. As WFYI education reporter Eric Weddle reports, school leadership sees improving academics as vital at Arlington as it becomes the first school under state intervention to transition back to its home district.
On a regular day, this is what Arlington's hallways sound like. But for the past 2 weeks, it's been a much different vibe. Something like this.
It's just a very calm, very soothing environment in here. You're not addressing all those little pieces, you know, the dress code and things like that. We're getting focused on the instruction in here. Were they talking about legislatures in number five?
No. No, they weren't talking about legislatures.
Okay, so I think we better throw B out.
That's Kevin Sandorf. He's one of a handful of teachers who have given up part or all of their fall break for this intensive teaching session. The goal is to help students bone up on math and English skills so they can pass exams required for graduation. About 80 juniors and seniors from Arlington were ordered to attend the two-week session, but more than half of the students assigned to Sandorf's English class didn't show up. Those who are get his hyperactive, highly interactive teaching style.
And, you know, you've got the numbers in here right now that you definitely could do a one-on-one or pause, ask, do you understand this? We can back up. We can look at this a little bit more.
Students and teachers agree this is the first time there's been peace and quiet in the school. While eating lunch in the cafeteria, junior Monet Peavy says she wants Arlington to be frozen in time, like it is now, free of distractions and rambunctious students.
Like me, I have to have a teacher like right there, like showing me the steps, not like talking in front of the whole class, because then I won't understand. You know, like that's how I learn better.
And as a junior, Peavy should have taken these exams last year or earlier. When IPS took back control of the school, administrators discovered that some students were never given the opportunity to take these tests, even though they're required for graduation. While they try to figure out why some students slip through the cracks, they say it's critical for them to spend their fall break prepping.
One, because a lot of the students have never been exposed to the test, and so they really don't know what it looks like and what they need to specifically study for.
That's Azalea Allen. She works in the guidance office.
But it's also important because you need to exhaust every opportunity that you get in order to be able to pass the test. So the kids, they're pretty anxious to get in and, you know, be able to pass it.
Without it, students can't earn a full high school diploma, and that's a big problem, not just for them, but Arlington. That's because IPS promised the state that it would improve Arlington's pass rate on these exams and also the overall graduation rate. That was a condition of IPS taking control of the school again.
Good job. 77X plus 3. Monet, what's the next one? What's 17?
Jeremy, you're rushing through these.
Around the corner from Sandorf's class, math instructors Tim Davis and Olanda Gardner split their time with just a handful of students. That lets them zero in on different topics, from graphing to quadratic equations. They also emphasize testing tips.
And just the little things they'll take points off of, like forget R's, you know, the variables, things like that. Monet, you got 11?
Students will have a chance in December to pass right. This year's required Monterey, math and English exams. 90.1 WFYI News. I'm Eric Weddle.
Eric is spending a year reporting from Arlington Community High School as it transitions from a state takeover back to IPS. For more of his stories, go to WFYI.org/a new day. That's it for this edition of the WFYI Weekly News Podcast. We encourage you to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can listen on SoundCloud. Just search WFYI. You can also follow WFYI News online at WFYI.org, on Twitter at WFYI News, and on Facebook, WFYI. This has been a production of WFYI News, produced at 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm Christopher Ayers. Thanks for listening.